And we suddenly became commissioners instead of councilmen. And the mayor was not elected. He was one of us. In other words, he was a commissioner, and we, the commission would elect the mayor from amongst ourselves. We began to have our first problems with beach erosion during that period. And it was getting pretty bad over in the North Beach area. So we were advised to put in a seawall up there. We contracted for that. As I was saying, we did contract for and have built a seawall on the entire North Beach from the pavilion on north of the city line. And this seemed to be a satisfactory solution, but as time went on, we found the erosion problem, especially on the South Beach, was just getting away from us. It was chewing up the beach and fast approaching our Ocean Boulevard. That's the street that runs parallel to A1A, but it's on the ocean front. We thought we had better do something about acquiring more beach for public beach at the same time, and this would allow us to take control of it, and if we had any solutions in mind for beach erosion control, if we owned the beach, then we could go ahead with whatever plans we had. The existing property owners saw it that way, most of them did, and seemed eager to get rid of their beachfront property, which was no longer suitable for building on, because there just wasn't enough depth. So this allowed us to purchase 1,000 feet of beach south of the pier for about $68,000. It's about $68 a front foot, which was a very cheap price. Well, we were not taking advantage of those people because in a short time they would have no beach anyway. But in the light of history in later years, it was a marvelous deal for the city because it allowed them to have expand the public beach tremendously, so that the public could look forward to in the future more public beach. And as history has shown in Miami, there is very precious little public beach down there in most other towns except Fort Lauderdale and to a certain extent Pompano. Most of the other towns were in a similar position, not too much beach available to the public. So I felt that, in retrospect, was one of the significant things that we accomplished in the 2 years that I was on the commission. Also, getting our city manager form of government, eventually our first attempt at getting a city manager was not too successful. He was just not suitable. But through a little trial and error, after about 5 years, we finally got a good man, and he did much to reorganize the city administration and give us the good management that we have today. We also, recognizing that we were on the cutting edge of the town coming into its own, emerging, as it were, from a mere agricultural town, kind of backwards in a way, we realized that we were going to have to do something about public works, meaning we would have to start planning for expansion of water facilities, be thinking about sewage and so on. So we proposed and had passed by referendum the first substantial bond issue for public works since way back in the 1920s, when they were first building the first water plants and the lighting system in the town. Since then, of course, there have been other substantial improvements as the town has grown from a small town, as it was at that time, of about 5,000 people to where it is today in 1986, the population of about 50,000. At any rate, I decided that while it had been a good experience for me to be a city commissioner, that I had done my civic duty and I was ready to get back and spend the time that I needed to spend on my business. So I elected not to run for re-election and just finished out my term of 2 years. I'm going to go back now in retrospect and just pick up on a couple of things that I omitted before. First of all, I want to mention that the story about Louis Zimmerman and being turned down by him in the first year of my business was very disappointing. But I decided a few years later, this was after W.A. Hart had removed himself from the association with Deerfield Builder Supply, that maybe I would have another go at talking to Louis Zimmerman, as he was still the outstanding builder in the area. But I was just about to go up and talk to him when one day, who comes walking in the driveway of the lumberyard but Louis Zimmerman? And instead of having that rough look on his face that I remember when I first met him, he had a big smile on his face. And he came up into the office and he said, "I understand Bill Hart is no longer associated with your company." And I said, "Well, yes, that's right. He has divested himself of his stock and his association with the company." And he says, "Good." He says, "Let's do some business now." And from that point on, he was one of the most congenial customers that I could ever want to have. He bought everything that he possibly could from me. We just got along famously. So it was that one sticking point that he held that matter against Bill Hart, the fact that Bill Hart had been the successful bidder, as it turned out, against him in building the Boca Raton Air Base. And he just couldn't get over that. He was not going to put any money in that so-and-so Bill Hart's pocket. So we did business right up to the time that he decided to retire from the construction business. And as I say, it was really a wonderful working relationship. Now, while we were still living in Fort Lauderdale, remembering that we moved up about early 1954, and that's when we had concluded the deal with Wilbur Kratz and took over 100% ownership of Deerfield Builder Supply, I drove back and forth, drove a truck every night home, and my routine would be to take orders that on the day, any given day, and things that I didn't have in stock, I would try to then pick up from my major wholesalers in Fort Lauderdale in the morning with the truck and bring them back and deliver them. This allowed me to maintain a much lower inventory level and thus took much less operating capital. And I could give excellent service too, because I didn't have to wait for deliveries from the wholesalers to me. Our children were now beginning to become toddlers and grow up a little bit. By 1952 or 3, Joanna was about 10, and Chrissy was about 6 or 7. Well, in the summertime, when they were not in school, to give them a little break, we would say, "Would you like to go to work with Daddy today?" Well, on several occasions, Emily would take me down to the FEC railroad station downtown, and Chrissy was the one that seemed to be most interested in going up. Eddie was not born yet, by the way. He was born in 1950. Chrissy seemed right ready for this little escapade or experience, and she would go with me, and we would get on the local railroad train, the earliest one in the morning, which was around 7 o'clock or so, and we would ride the train up to Deerfield, and they would make a stop for us. We were the only passenger to get off, but they would stop the train, and we would hop right off there at Deerfield Builder Supply. Well, that was quite an experience, and I know Chrissy just got the biggest kick out of that. And her mother would fix up her little lunch, and in a brown bag, as she did mine. And when it came lunchtime, Chrissy and I would spread our lunch out on my desk. And in the meantime, she would bring her coloring books along and her little books that she was capable of reading at that time. And she would keep herself amused that way. Then when it came time to go home at the end of the day, about 5:30 or 6 o'clock, we would catch the southbound train. It would stop for us. And they would drop us off in Fort Lauderdale Station, and Emily would pick us up there. Chrissy and Joe and later on Eddie all did their part in helping the fledgling company grow. They all were interested in it. And they all did little jobs within their capability. Chrissy especially seemed interested in Deerfield Builder Supply, and we said there was a radio, a popular radio show at that time called Ma Perkins. Ma Perkins was a lady who owned and operated a lumberyard in a small town, someplace I suppose out in the Midwest. But we said that Chrissy was going to grow up to be another Ma Perkins, that she would end up maybe someday running the lumberyard. Well, as history has shown, she was destined to marry David Flagg and live in another area, but we always wondered whether Chrissy might not have ended up being in our management team. Now, also in the early days, another customer that I was trying to develop, this was early on in 1947-48. This customer was developing quite a name for himself. His name was Bob Sullivan. And he was known in the territory as Captain Sullivan. Well, being a Navy man, to me, a captain, if he were a captain in the Navy, that would be equivalent to a colonel in the Army or Air Force. And I said, I've got to meet this man. He must be pretty outstanding. He's a builder. Apparently, he's made the transition into civilian life and is developing quite a name for himself as a builder. So I found out where he lived in Pompano, and I dropped by his house. Well, I was very surprised to find this rather short young man, quite a bit younger than I was. And he was not a captain in the Navy, of course, but a captain in the Air Force. He'd been a pilot in the Air Force during the war, and it seems at the end of the war he had seen duty at Boca Raton Air Base in the engineering department. Well, he was a very cocky young Irishman, and I found out right away where I stood with him. I introduced myself as having this little lumberyard in Deerfield, and I said, I'd like to sell you building materials. You seem to be quite active now, and I'd like to be your lumber dealer. And in a very testy voice, he said, I've had it with you lumber dealers. He said, you all give me, you lump me in with whatever bad experience he had had with other lumber dealers to this point, but he stated it in this way. He said, you give me prices and I go bid jobs, and then when I go to buy the materials, why, the prices go up and I lose money on the job. He said, I'm not buying from you people anymore. I'm going to open my own lumber yard. And I thought, boy, just like that. I know what's involved in opening a lumber yard. It's not easy. Well, sure enough, he built a building. He called his company the Deerfield Lumber and Hardware Company, Deerfield Beach Lumber and Hardware Company, and built a building right across the street from our present city hall. And he went into it in a big way. He hired his father-in-law as the manager of the hardware store. He had two or three clerks running around there. They built out and back a lumber shed and stocked that up with lumber, and he had steel, reinforcing steel, which was very hard to get at that time, and cement. I said, where on earth is he getting all these short items and difficult items? Well, it turned out he was buying them from Pacific Lumber Company in Fort Lauderdale, and he was paying them contractors' prices and expected to turn right around and develop a contractor business out of that. Well, with this great auspicious beginning and with a big grand opening, I thought, boy, I guess I'm really in for trouble now. He's probably going to run me out of business. And he sure got the cockiness and self-esteem to do it. Well, to make a long story short, he lasted about 6 months. In the meantime, the other lumber companies cut him off, and he came with, more or less with his hat in his hands, to buy materials from me. And sure enough, after about 6 months, he went under. And he owed me some money. Not a whole lot, a couple hundred dollars, I guess it was. Well, I went over to see him. I'd heard that he was in trouble. And he admitted to me that he was going to have to close up. And I said, well, what about the 200 and some dollars you owe me? He said, come on in here. He says, took me in the back room of the hardware store, and he says, here, help yourself. Take out whatever I owe you in trade here. And I did. There was a lot of stuff that I really didn't need, but I wasn't going to get stuck, so I took out my whatever he owed me in trade. Well, that didn't mean the end for Bob Sullivan. He was not to be put out of business or out of commission that easily. It closed up his operation there, but somehow he managed to regroup and kept right on building. But from that point on, he always had credit problems. But his attitude towards buying from me changed, I guess probably because I was one of the few that would sell him. Anyway, I began to do more and more business with him. And before I realized it, he was into me for pretty substantial sums. Well, one day he advised me that he was getting ready for a big development in Deerfield. He said, I'm buying some land over in the area between the Intercoastal Waterway and the Federal Highway, and I'm going to start a development there. It's going to be called the Cove. There's going to be a marina. We're going to dig a yacht basin in there, and oh, he laid it out, all these grandiose ideas. Well, I said to myself, where in the world is he going to get money to do all that? He owes me about $8,000 now, and I'm having a hard time getting any money out of him. Well, sure enough, within a short time, he announced the fait accompli. He had managed to talk W.L. Kester, who was a large landowner, very substantial citizen, who owned quite a bit of property in Deerfield and had built houses in Deerfield, which he rented. He had talked W.L. Kester, who was noted for being rather crusty and hard to do business with, Bob Sullivan, with his Irish brogue, I mean his Irish ability to convince, had talked him into selling about 250 acres down in this section. And as he even bragged later on, he said, I did it with an $8,000 down payment. Well, I thought to myself, why, you so-and-so, that's the $8,000 you owed me that I've been trying to get out of you for all this time. Well, his philosophy was, you go along with me on something like this. Sure, I owe you money, but this is going to be a great thing. It's going to mean a lot of business for you because we're going to be building houses and I'm going to sell lots and it's going to be a big development down there. Well, that turned out to be right on the money. It became a very successful, it was slow at first, but he became a very successful developer, developing the Cove, and that was only the beginning. He built many houses down there, but more importantly, he sold a lot of lots and brought a lot of other builders in there who did bring some business to us. Over the years, Sullivan bought probably $500,000 worth from me. And at one time, he owed me over $32,000. And believe me, I was losing plenty of sleep over that. Emily would tell you that I would wake up in the middle of the night and pace around, and what was causing me all this worry was this money that Sullivan owed me, and I was having a very difficult time getting it out of him. Well, he went on to do other developments, including Venetian Isles and Crystal Lake. Crystal Lake being nothing but some old abandoned rock pits. And he cleaned up the edges, bought the land, cleaned up the edges, and the next thing you know, he's calling them Crystal Lake. Well, I would have called them Milky Lake because they were still milky colored from the residue that had been put into solution by more recent digging of rock out of them. Eventually, Sullivan went broke, and in the final analysis, I was stuck for about $13,000. And I guess in retrospect, considering all the business I did with him, probably the loss wasn't too bad. But any loss is not good, of course. And I even today, I wonder if there isn't some way to get it back, but he is at present time is managing for somebody else the country club out in Crystal Lake that he originally built and developed and lost during his financial demise. Our business in 1950s was moving along rather slowly. Down below us, especially in the Fort Lauderdale area, and then to a larger degree in Pompano, things were really booming. And then we thought, well, we're next. This we're going to have a big boom here, hopefully by, say, mid-50s or late-50s. Or early 60s, it's our turn. We won't be any longer a small farming town, but we'll be a developing town, and this should make good business for us in the building industry, in the lumber yard. Unaccountably, it leapfrogged right over us and went to Boca Raton. Boca Raton caught a fire, mainly because of the development of Florida Atlantic University. That caused the town to catch fire. Well, here we were still kind of sitting there withering on the vine. But we tried to do a few things in the town. We were stymied in trying to get new industry in the town because most of the land, which was suitable as to location to do industrial development, was held by two entities. One was a private person who was a dairy farmer. He owned a large, several hundred acres of land. And the other being the Seaboard Coastline Railroad. And neither of these two entities seemed interested in the town or developing the town. They figured, well, we're going to, someday the land is going to be worth something, and we're going to wait and hold off and get the top dollar for it. So, no industry, the town stagnates, right? If we could have only looked ahead to the middle and late 70s, we would have taken heart, because that was when industrial development began to catch fire. And today, in 1986, we have one of the most active and well-developed industrial areas of any town up and down the line. In 1957, which was actually 1956, and I was still on the city commission, I was approached to join a group that was planning on getting a charter for a state bank in Deerfield, which would be called Deerfield Beach Bank. And I agreed to go along with this. I think they wanted me partly because of my political affiliation as a town city commissioner, and partly because I was a local businessman. But I did join this organizing group, and we had to wait about 2 years to get our charter because Boca Raton had gotten their first bank, and it was a state charter as well. And the Commissioner of Banking in Tallahassee felt that another bank so close to Boca Raton would have to wait so that the Boca Raton Bank could have a chance to consolidate its beginnings and not be threatened by another bank so close. So eventually, in 1957, we did get our charter, and we opened with $1 million on our opening day, which was more than we had even planned. Well, the bank, we had hired a team of experienced bankers, Percy White and Art Henson, who had been affiliated with a bank in Peoria, Illinois, and they turned out to be good conservative bankers. My first position, in addition to being a founding director, was I was elected a vice president, not as an active officer, but more or less as a title representing the community, so to speak. Later on, I would be elected, moved up the line to be vice chairman of the board. Alvin Jones had been the original president and chairman of the board, and he eventually gave up his title as president and just retained the title of chairman of the board. We had an agreement that we would maintain control of the bank, at least 51% of the stock, within our board of directors. And if any one of us ever found it necessary or wanted to sell our stock, we would offer it to the other members of the board first. We had trouble right away with one of the directors, Henry Mellon, who was a kind of an undependable person, a developer, and he, through an intermediary, let us know that he was going to have to sell his stock, but he wanted a pretty good figure for it, which gave him a good profit. Well, we didn't dare let it get into other hands, so we each had to take a proportion of the shares. All of this now created extra financial problems for all of us, because each time we took shares of stock, either from somebody like that, or if we had to buy additional stock, as we were doing, seems, in the early days, almost yearly, in order to satisfy the state banking commission as to their capital requirements, we'd each have to dig down in our pockets and come up with money. Well, I was constantly in hock to the bank, or the First National Bank. We couldn't borrow from our own bank, but I would have to borrow from the First National Bank in Fort Lauderdale to pay for the stock. So it was almost for about 10 years that I was in hock, coming up periodically with enough money. Well, this didn't worry me because I figured the value of the stock would increase, and it has over the year and its years. And I still have all the original stock now in 1986 that I had to begin with, plus all the additional stock that I was required to buy, and it is worth a very substantial amount today. Eventually, Alvin Jones decided to unload his stock, and he didn't bring it to the board as we had agreed, but sold it to an outsider, and this outsider, along with one of our directors, put a majority of stock together and sold the bank out from under us. They sold it to Southeast Banking Corporation in Miami, and we were all pretty upset about it, but there wasn't anything we could do because Alvin Jones held this very large block of stock, and he could pretty well call the shots. Well, we got a new chairman of the board right away. Alvin had to step down because he no longer had any stock. And our management was brought us, first Percy was, Percy White was continued to be our president, but he also became the new chairman of the board. This status remained this way for 3 or 4 years. Then Southeast decided to make their presence more known. They sent Jim Brown up to become the new president and chairman, and Percy was eased out, and he decided to retire then. When Jim Brown left, Southeast sent us a new president named Dave Wallard, a very smart, sharp young man, whom they had just hired from out in Arizona, Phoenix, and Dave Waller became president. Well, I was very surprised and pleased one day, soon after that, that Dave called me in his office and he said, "How would you like to be chairman of the board?" And I said, "Me? I think there are two or three others that probably are more qualified." And no, you are the one that they want. And I soon found out that I had been recommended by Jim Brown, who had been the recently president and chairman of the board. He felt that I was the appropriate man. So I had the great experience of being chairman of the board of that bank, and it was still growing, and in the next 2 years became the leading bank in the system as far as profitability. And this made me even happier. Well, I couldn't take much credit for that. It was Dave Wallard, who was a very sharp young man, and it was he that deserved most of the credit. However, after 2 years, Southeast decided to take all of their banks, and there were five others in Broward County, and combine them into one bank. So we now had a new bank called, we no longer had a board at Deerfield. Most of our directors were retired, but there were about four of us that were retained, and we went down and became a part of a new board of a bank called the Southeast Bank of Broward County. And I was a director in this board for 3 or 4 years. Then a further change was made in which they made the Southeast Bank into a unit bank, meaning the First National Bank of Miami became the lead bank, and all other banks, some 130 or 40 of them in the state, including ours, just became branches or banking centers. Well, now there was a further attrition, and a number of those directors who had been directors of the Broward Bank were retired, but I was lucky enough to be retained on as a consultant, to be a member of a board of consultants for Region 3, which included Broward, Palm Beach, Martin, and St. Lucie counties. And this is what I have been, my status has been for the last about 4 years, and more recently they expanded our Region 3 to include Monroe, Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, Martin, St. Lucie counties, and the bank now has assets, our Region 3, of which I'm still a consultant, has assets of $2.5 billion. Pretty good sized bank. I just reached age 70, and I believe that I would have to retire, but when I talked to the Regional 3 vice president, who's Dave Allcamp, who's pretty well up in the hierarchy of Southeast Bank, he said, no, there's no need for you to retire. We have a couple of others who have reached age 70, so we're going to restructure the board of consultants later in the year, but you'll still be a member of the board of consultants, but we're going to break it down into smaller groups. So we'll see how that turns out. As for Deerfield Builder Supply, we seem to be making pretty good progress, and we came up to about 1973, and a major breakthrough occurred in Deerfield. It almost didn't happen, and there were many of us who were really not keen about it, in fact, really fought it, but it turned out we couldn't do anything about it. That was the advent of Century Village. Century Village being a large and successful condominium developer in West Palm Beach. Well, the reason we didn't want them in Deerfield was we had heard some horror stories about the kind of people that lived up there. They were, for the most part, belonged to an ethnic group of Jewish people, most of whom came from one small area in New York City, known as Queens, which is an enclave of Jewish people, amongst other ethnic people up there. Once we found that they were going to come in anyway, they were going to make a legal test. The city commission was trying to keep them out. Once the city commission found that they were going to be tested in court, they finally caved in and they let them come in and start their development. Well, at first, we could see it was going to be a huge operation. They were proposing to build about 8,000 units. That would be the largest single condominium development at that time in the state of Florida. Well, we thought, this isn't going to be much for us. They're probably going to be buying carloads direct from mills and manufacturers and so on, and we will get the door shut right in our face. And the first project manager was very cool toward us, and we did a little business with him, but we just didn't seem to be getting anywhere. Well, after about a year and a half, he was out, and they brought a new project manager in, and things turned around quickly. We designated Howard Bannister, who was one of our salesmen, to be the salesman of record out there. And I went out, made myself known, talked with the project manager, got a good reception. The next thing we know, they're asking us for bids. And to make a long story short, we became the largest supplier of building materials. We didn't sell everything, but we eventually were selling all the lumber, all the millwork, anything made of wood, We didn't always sell the roof sheathing. That's a football that gets kicked around pretty bad in our industry and especially in our area. But at the peak of our doing business with them out there, we were selling as high as $160,000 and $170,000 a month. While we were working on shorter margins than most of our contractor accounts, we still had a fairly good profit built in there because the development was close to us. We didn't have long runs to make. We were shipping in large quantities for the most part, in truckload lots. And we had an excellent method of servicing them. And that was what pleased them, I think, more than anything. They had some other problems with getting poor service from other lumber yards. So we really developed an excellent working condition, working conditions with them until they completed that project. And that project went on, just really only wound up about 1982 or 3. And the project manager, Harry Ault, who was just one peach of a fellow, a very quiet spoken, but a very much a professional, we developed just an excellent rapport with him, and I later on developed even a closer personal relationship to him. He's retired now. But we went on to when they decided to build another project out west of Boca Raton, they were managed by the same project manager, and we were in there too. So we furnished everything out there, did very well there. So for a period of perhaps 11 years, we had a very profitable and excellent working relationship with Century Village. And we still sell them, even though both projects are completed, we still sell them materials, have a pretty good account on a much smaller basis to take care of some of their maintenance and any additions that they ever have to build and so on. They are building another project of about the same, not quite as large size, in Pembroke Pines. But we did not push hard to try to get in there because it's too far away. It's a long haul down there. It ties up a truck half a day just to run down with a delivery down there. So we have never tried very hard to consolidate our position. Now, here we are up into 1986, and I have stepped down as president these past 3 years. Ed H., Emily's, and my only son is now the president, and he's doing an excellent job. He has new ideas, fresh outlook on life. He's now will be 36 years old in about 6 weeks. He's matured very well. I have found that it's best for me to step aside and not try to inhibit him because he knows what he's doing. I'm very happy with the way he's carrying out his job. And not only that, but it has given me the freedom at my time of life to do other things that I would like to be doing. I still like to come in. I still have my office, and I'm given respect as the chairman of the board, which I am now, but I don't flaunt that title by any means. In addition to our regular business, we are known as a contractor-oriented yard, meaning that we sell about 80% of our materials to contractors, the other 20% spread through the market of do-it-yourselfers, private individuals, industrial accounts, hotels and motels. In addition to that, we have now a thriving export business, which is a part of our wholesale business that Eddie put together about 2 years ago. And at the present time, we're not just sure how, where it's going to lead to, but if we can learn a little more about it and keep our sales personnel in that division under control, it may turn out to be one of our more profitable adjuncts. We also have a cabinet division, which we've had now for about 4 years, and we've had our ups and downs in there, but at the present time, through some reorganization, it's going very well. We have three people in that department, and they're very smart and very hardworking, including two young ladies. As I had said, I stepped down as president, but was given the title and was elected and given the title of chairman of the board and treasurer. And I consider my duties there as making me a semi-active. When people say to me, well, how are you enjoying retirement? I have to quickly say to them, well, I don't consider myself fully retired. I call myself semi-retired. I like to keep somewhat active in the business. I love the business. It's like a child to me that I have reared, and I want to see it grow up and become hale and hearty, just like our three natural children. Emily has been, from the early days when we bought out Wilbur Kretz, has been the corporate secretary, and she has taken a very interested part and has been a big help in you being a sounding board, and through her interest in the company, she has been a very substantial part of the success of the business. As I wind up this little life story, if you want to call it that, I have to say that at some points in developing the company, I let my outside interests perhaps get a little too